When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to Peoples and Things, where we explore human life with technology. I'm Lee Vinsel. As you may know, I've been working on a book tentatively titled A Good History of Shit Jobs. It examines changes in numbers, types, and qualities of jobs in the United States from the 1970s to the present as a way of answering the question, why is it that, as United Way's ALICE program routinely points out, about 40% of American households can barely afford to make ends meet? One of the first historical test pits I've dug for this book project is to examine something called the new economy, which was a phrase frequently used during the Clinton administration. The phrase described a quickly expanding economy that many figures attributed to new information and communications technologies, like personal computers and the internet. Boosters of the new economy idea believe that it would give rise to a new period of abundance and prosperity, perhaps even greater than the post-World War II boom. And the only question was how to get poor people and those historically marginalized in corporate white-collar settings, including women and Black and Latino people, the skills they needed to succeed in the new economy so that the great new bounty would be equally distributed. In retrospect, talk of the new economy was bubble thinking. It involved perceiving a temporary spurt of growth, yes, perhaps in part driven by new technologies, and assuming that the expansion would be long-lived and persistent. It was not. If you examine use of the phrase the new economy in Google's Ngram tool, which tracks use of words and exact phrases over time, you will see that the phrase falls off a cliff face in 2002, which was the height of the dot-com bust that began in 2000. This also suggests that chatter about the new economy was tied to the dot-com-centered stock market mania of the 1990s. It was irrational exuberance. What has also stood out to me as I've looked into this history is just how much the new economy of the 1990s makes the tech bubble of the past decade, all of the excitement around the sharing economy, self-driving cars, drones, the metaverse, and Web3, multiple rounds of AI chatter, the list goes on, it makes it all feel like deja vu. The difference is that at least the new economy was a growth spurt that delivered economically, whereas the tech bubble of the past decade mostly has not. As I began reading into the history of the new economy, my favorite piece of writing I have found is economic journalist and broadcaster Doug Henwood's After the New Economy. Published in 2003, the book is a kind of autopsy of a recently deceased economic beast, and the book is a rant and a romp, full of schadenfreude and insightful, mean jokes. Henwood is an interesting guy. Today, he is host of the audio program Behind the News, which is broadcast on KPFA and is also available as a podcast. For nearly 30 years, he was the author and publisher of the Left Business Observer, a newsletter that gave Marx-inflected analyses of Wall Street, financial markets, and business news. In this way, Henwood has, for decades, been one of the most reliable and long-lived leftist analysts of the economy. And After the New Economy, his book, was one product of that work. And it's a great one. I had a lot of fun chatting with Doug, whose work I have been following since I was a young grad student. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hey, get excited! Doug, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Oh, good to be here. I've been looking forward to this. I think we share a similar perspective on this craziness of the new economy.
That's right. I think that's right.
Endlessly renewing, self-renewing.
Yeah. So, you know, I started writing about the, you know, so-called new economy a couple years ago. And your book, After the New Economy, which I'd already read in grad school at some point in like 2005 or six or something like that, kind of increasingly became important to me. And I know it's always funny looking back at something you wrote, you know, so many years ago. But, you know, when you look back now, like, how do you understand the book? And what, in retrospect, do you think you were trying to do with it at the time?
Well, you know, I started thinking about this stuff in the late 90s when the first, you know, the dot-com bubble and the first new economy mania was really in full riot. And I kept looking at this. This is all insane. I remember at one point, The Nation magazine had a deal with something called pseudo.com. Huh. Pseudo was this very short-lived media conglomerate that got more space at the 2000 Democratic Convention than some established news organizations. So it was a phenomenon. So The Nation had this deal. So Nation writers would go talk to them and be on their videos, and who knows how many people watched them. But I walked over to this. It was this nice building in Soho, the Puck Building, kind of a famous building in Soho. I walked over there and walked in, and it was just an enormous operation with all this equipment and scores of young people running around looking busy and important. And I thought, what is going on here? This can't last. And it didn't last. It was dead about a year later. And then the founder of it, whose name I can't remember, ended up doing a webcam of himself as a barista. He just couldn't give up the limelight. But then he disappeared. I don't know what ever happened to this guy. But I think pseudo.com, you know, it's like, okay, you're making a joke. You know, everything in the 90s was all about the irony. And it was very much in that spirit. But, you know, it's like, how does this go on? I remember walking up and down the streets of the Lower East Side, which had, you know, just 10 years earlier been junkie paradise, and there are all these new restaurants and young people eating expensive meals. Like, where is this money coming from? How is this going to go on? And it didn't. You know, it started with the 95 Netscape IPO, I think, and lasted until the spring of 2000. I thought, man, this is not going to end well. I was started working on the book, and then I had my first marriage fell apart. So I never got the time. I didn't finish it in a timely manner. And so it didn't come out for a couple of years after it, until after it crashed. But I thought, okay, this is dead. I'm going to kick it when it's down and hope it never stands up again. Yeah. And it didn't for some time. But then it came back, and you saw like the unicorns and the VC manias, the free money from the Fed, which fed it all. I guess, man, here we are again. And what struck me during that period, and now it seems to be over, you know, with interest rates higher, money not flowing so freely, it seems to be over, at least for now. Although there's talk the IPO channel is going to revive. But in any case, what struck me is that in many ways it was a repetition. The first time is comedy. The second time is, I don't know what, bathos? There's for as crazy as the late 90s mania was, there was an exuberance to it, a utopianism to it, and a freshness to it that is just not around this time. And, you know, people thought at that time that, you know, this is going to change the world. It's going to really transform capitalism. It's going to be a different society. And it was, a lot of it was ludicrous, but at least there was some kind of utopian impulse there. And now what, you know, the achievements of this round have been what, ordering a sandwich and a cab. And it just doesn't have that same utopian impulse. It's so much less fun. Maybe it's just because I'm older and my attitude towards the world is sour and, you know, more death driven, but, it just watching it happen again, it's been the strangest sensation. And again, I had the same sensation. This can't last. This is insane. And everybody, you know, says, oh, you just don't understand. It's all really new. And it didn't last. But who knows, it may stand up again, as it so often does.
I know, man. It is a wild thing. Well, first of all, you know, there'll be some listeners of this episode who, you know, maybe were born after 2000, who don't know this term new economy, or they just forgotten it, or they repressed it for people who were alive in the 90s. So, you know, like, what was the new economy? And, you know, do you remember how you first became aware of it? Was it just everywhere at the time?
Well, it kind of was everywhere. And actually, Tom Frank gave me a little lesson in the etymology of the term. It was originally coined by, can't remember what nationality, but it's a socialist. And they're talking about a real new economy, not a post-capitalist economy. And that was the first appearance of the term in English decades earlier. I can't remember exactly when. I wrote about that in the book, but I can't remember exactly when. But it started becoming really prominent around the time of the Netscape IPO, 95. Wired magazine was singing this anthem of novelty. People like Lou Rosetto, one of the founders of Wired, who is the guy who wrote New Rules for the New Economy.
Kevin Kelly.
Yeah, Kevin Kelly, who I interviewed that guy on my radio show. I don't have the recording of it, but man, that guy was just an asshole, an intolerable person. Yeah. He would just thought everything was so wonderful just because, you know, Marie Antoinette did not have Aspern, therefore she wasn't really rich. He'd make stupid arguments like that. But, you know, I'd read Wired magazine and think, man, this is crazy stuff. Yeah. And it was all about the new economy, new rules for the new economy. There was an accountant, Baruch Lev at NYU Business School, who was trying to translate some of the principles of the pure exuberance into something like accounting principles. And, you know, you think accounting, this is just the opposite of crazy dreaming. Accounting is all about rationality and everything has to balance and make sense. And, you know, it's all about hard limits. And he was, however, trying to make the accounting profession new. He had these ideas that, for example, his profession, accounting, was too hung up in the transaction. And he was all about intangible value. And you didn't actually need to sell something to create value, which, you know, struck me as this, you know, that's just not capitalism. That's not how it works. If you don't sell something, you may have some imaginary value, but if you can't realize it in the form of money, you got nothing. And so I thought, this stuff is wild. I think he actually won a prize called the Wildman Prize, which I thought was funny. But, you know, here he was at NYU Business School, you know, a distinguished institution, a professor of accounting, saying things that seemed to me absolutely nonsensical. I interviewed this guy who ran a mutual fund, the net thing. It was actually wrote this for Wired because I kind of knew some of the people who worked at Wired. Mm-hmm. And one of them asked me to do something about this fund. It was called the Net Fund. And it was just all about internet-related companies. And I interviewed the portfolio manager. I said, how do you value a company that has no profits? And he said, oh, it's great. It's better that way. You don't have to worry about traditional valuation models. So the lack of profit was something he saw as liberating. So I thought, you know, these guys are trying to repeal several centuries of capitalist discipline and logic, and it's just not going to last. And it didn't. but it was a wild time. And you know, it didn't come back with the same, I don't know, kind of philosophical framework that it had in the late 90s. But the idea was that technology, the internet specifically, but ICT, you know, computing and communications technology, information processing stuff, was going to transform the way we live, transform everything about society. It was going to end the business cycle. It was going to flatten hierarchies. It was going to make work fun. It was going to be a disalienating thing. Everybody's going to be happy. And technology and the kind of social organization that it enabled was going to bring joy to us all. And I just thought, man, that's just not the way it works. When there's a party going on, you don't want to be the one on the sidelines naysaying. It's not a pleasant role, but there I was, you know, on the sidelines naysaying. It was a wild time. And New York, you know, Lower Manhattan was one of the centers of it. It wasn't quite like the Bay Area, but there's a lot going on in Lower Manhattan, Silicon Alley. So I saw this stuff going on. I'd see these people. I'd see these billboards. They had this giant Welcome to Silicon Alley thing just over the Flatiron Building.
Oh, wow.
That didn't last either. But I don't think anybody remembers the term Silicon Alley except oldsters like me.
Yeah, it might have come back in the 2010s. I'm not sure. So one of the things I like to do in this podcast is kind of give listeners a sense of folks as, like, you know, career trajectories and, you know, who they are, how they became who they are. So I first became aware of your work through your old newsletter, The Left Business Observer, which I gather you founded in like 1986.
Yeah, 1986 to 2013.
And so how did you become the guy who, what was The Left Business Observer, and how did you become the guy who made it?
Well, there's something of a story to it. I originally was an English major in college. I did 3 years of graduate English at the University of Virginia. I decided I really didn't want to pursue an academic career, so I did my orals and then left ABD. Maybe I'll write a dissertation, maybe I won't. But, you know, and then I was tired of living in Charlottesville. It was kind of dull, and I wanted to move to New York. So I moved to New York, got a job in publishing, medical publishing. And, you know, I was hoping to be some sort of glamorous editor or something someday. But, I ended up in medical and technical publishing. Well, it wasn't bad. It was a pretty good job, a nice place to start. And then I quit that job to write my dissertation. I was going to write my dissertation. And I did some typesetting. I learned how to operate an early computerized typesetting machine. Then my then wife and I got into book indexing. We did books indexes for the publisher that we both used to work for. And it gave me a lot of free time. It was very flexible and it made a decent amount of money. So I thought, you know, I was reading a lot of the business press when I was going to do my dissertation. I was going to write about American poetry, evolution of narcissism in American poetry. It's going to be pretty psychoanalytic in its orientation. But I then got the idea of tying it to the changes in the political economy, the underlying political economy, from sort of the competitive small-scale stuff of Emerson's day, early 19th century. And the major figure I was going to write about was Wallace Stevens, who worked for an insurance company in Hartford, Connecticut. So he's, you know, in high finance and a very different kind of economy from Emerson's small-scale competitive capitalism. And I was going to take Stephen's role in finance seriously as part of what informed his aesthetic and his poetry and his view of life. I started reading political economy. I read Baron and Sweezy's Monopoly Capital, which I really was very influential on me. And in that book, they said the business press is really great. You should read if you're a Marxist, you should read the business press.
Yeah.
And so I started reading Business Week in particular, which I still subscribe to. Still has the same form of address that I had 40 years ago. Also Wall Street Journal. I started reading the Wall Street Journal, then the Financial Times. And I thought, I was reading Rock and Roll Confidential, which was Dave Marsh's newsletter on rock and roll, mostly rock and roll, but also other forms of popular music as well. And it was just an 8-page newsletter. And I thought, I could do one of these things. On economics. I think I could do economics and finance. And so I just got the idea, bought a Macintosh, one of the early Macintoshes, 1986, and decided, I'm going to start this newsletter. And as it turned out, I didn't really know what I was doing. But I, as the development economists say, I learned by doing. Just the first 20 issues or so were kind of embarrassing and amateurish. But since there weren't many people like me, I got some attention. I got some subscribers, not a vast number, but some. And Verso asked me to do a book on Wall Street, which I signed a contract for in 1989. And once I signed the contract, I said, oh my God, I don't really know what I'm doing. I'm in way over my head. What have I done? So it took me about 6 years to write the book because I really, like almost self-directed graduate education in reading economics and finance. And I never could quite get the advanced math, but, you know, I read an awful lot of the mainstream stuff and the Marxist and the Keynesian stuff. And, you know, I spent 6 years working on it. That's when I really felt like I started understanding what this stuff was all about. But it took me about 10 years of growing up in public with my pants down, as Lou Reed once said.
Nice. Yeah, and so that book, Wall Street, How It Works and For Whom, it came out in like 96, right? Like, so 10 years after.
Yeah, 96 was the hardcover, and then I updated it slightly for the paperback, 97.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, part of what I wanted to like set up there is, you know, by the time you get after the new economy, you've really been watching markets and technology and all this stuff for almost 20 years at that point when the book comes out, right? I mean, professionally.
Yeah. I mean, actually, I didn't mention my first job out of college was as a secretary, basically, for the chairman of a small brokerage firm. The firm went bust, and I only lasted there 6 months because the firm went under. But he was really ahead of his time. He had been a physicist at Bell Labs, and decided he was going to take all that math that he learned as a physicist and apply it to the financial markets. So they just started trading listed options when I got this job. And so he was trying to develop options pricing models and sell them to portfolio managers. And nobody knew what he was talking about. He was really way ahead of his time. Hmm. He eventually drank himself to death, alas. He was a really interesting guy, though. Thoughtful, kept a... He had a Baudelaire edition in his desk.
Whoa, okay.
he's not your standard Wall Street dude. But, you know, after I left that job, I was kind of bitten. I was always fascinated by Wall Street and the stock market. I don't know why. My uncle, who lived with us part of my time growing up, subscribed, got Barron's, and I used to read Barron's all the time. Alan Abelson's column in Barron's in particular. Alan... Well, I later got to be kind of friendly with, who gave me a nice blurb. He's deeply immersed in Wall Street, you know, editing this weekly magazine for Wall Street. But on the other hand, he was pretty contemptuous of a lot of the people involved. He thought they were kind of short-sighted and stupid and greedy. And so he was always had this mocking tone about, and he's a very good writer. And so he had this mocking tone, and I was like, that kind of shaped my view of things. But I was really, really interested in this world of Wall Street and had this love-hate relationship with it, which is analogous to my fascination with and love-hate relationship with the ruling class more broadly. I was this suburban kid from a completely undistinguished suburb in New Jersey. I went to...
Was it Teaneck, New Jersey? Is that what I read?
No, that's where I was born.
Okay.
I grew up in a place called Westwood, which is only known for James Gandolfini was also born there.
Okay.
And Eugene O'Neill's widow died there, I think. Those are the only significant things that ever happened in Western New Jersey. But I... Where was I going with that?
Well, just say that you're contempt for the ruling class, like, or tension around the ruling class.
So, I landed at Yale as an undergraduate. And I said, who are these people? You know, they got their names on buildings or their ancestors' portraiture on the wall. I didn't really have, and a lot of them went to fancy private schools. They studied Greek in high school. I said, my God, you know, who are these people? So that's developed this love-hate relationship with them as well. So, you know, money and social power and all that sort of thing have been my abiding topics of study now for like 40 years. I began the intro to Wall Street by saying that a psychoanalyst would have a field day with the fact that I spent so much time studying finance without making lots of money. I saw a shrink for a while who actually thought that it was a neurotic symptom that I was knew all this but didn't use it to make a lot of money.
Good.
But yeah,
like too many of us, I'm afraid. Yeah,
I've spent like several decades now studying these people who kind of run the world. My current obsession is what a rotten social formation they are. They can't even function as a proper ruling class anymore.
It's really sad in that way, for sure. Yeah, I hear you. After the new economy was slightly delayed because you had your personal life was falling apart there for a minute. Did you start writing it in 2000? Like, did you conceive of the book like in that early moment when like the dot-com bust was happening, or was it even earlier than that?
It was a little earlier, late 90s, like 98, okay. 99 probably. I can't remember what exactly the trajectory was.
Yeah.
But the NASDAQ was peaking in the spring of 2000. Just as my first marriage was falling apart. So all this stuff was happening. It's like, oh my God, everything I foretold is coming true now.
Yeah.
And I really couldn't write about it. I was in no shape to write about anything. So I remember I did manage to write one piece about the Time Warner AOL merger, I think it was. Like, this is insane. This is not going to work out.
Yeah.
And of course it didn't. But I was mostly out of commission for like as that moment was coming to fruition. Whatever the opposite of fruition is.
Right. Yeah, one of the great ironies of that moment is that the Clinton administration decides to hold like a conference on the new economy. It's like the title of the conference is something like the new economy. And it's like, I can't remember, they hold it literally like a month after the stock market starts to crater. And so it's just like, you know, there's these beautiful moments in the story.
Yeah, he was the perfect president for that moment in a lot of ways, too, because he's kind of dreamy and weird. Aside from all the sort of centrist pro-business Democrat stuff, he had these moments where he'd get lost in fantasies about, like, there's one speech he gave about a rich, soft wanting. We all want a rich, soft wanting. I was like, what is this guy talking about? But I mean, that kind of... And this is one of the striking about the contrast between him and Trump. Both snake oil salesmen in different sorts of ways. But you know, Clinton, at least, you know, this stuff about the bridge to the 21st century, don't stop thinking about tomorrow. There was a classic American optimistic view of the future there.
Yeah.
And now we have Trump, who is just nothing but nostalgic, but with a really sour flavor to it. It's just one longs for something more hopeful than the current political environment. You know, as fraudulent as it was, I was just looking at that old Edmund Wilson quote, which he wrote just after the stock market crash in 1929. And he said, one couldn't help but be exuberant at the collapse of that stupid, gigantic fraud. And you know, I felt that way in 2000. I felt that way last year as all that, you know, the meme stocks and all that nonsense and crypto, all that stuff was falling apart. Not completely yet, alas, but you know, that whole stupid gigantic fraud. It is a recurring feature of American life.
Yeah. Yeah, man. I was just reading an essay. So there's this essay by Robert Brenner and Dylan Riley that got everyone inflamed. It was in the New Left Review, and it was like, it's called Seven Theses on Political Capitalism or something, and got leftists all worked up. But one of the points in it's pretty bleak is just like, in a sense, it looks like a post-growth economy in a lot of ways. And we're dealing with like post-growth political parties as part of their argument. And I think it might partly account for that, the kind of grimness that you see in Trump and other folks.
Yeah, I have to admit, I haven't read those articles yet. I know people are getting very excited about them, and I feel like I should read them or should have read them already, but I haven't. But this issue around post-growth, that gets very complicated. All the degrowthers.
I wasn't going that way.
I know. But
yeah, I hear you.
I don't know. I think it's, as economists say, misspecified.
Yeah, I hear
but
you.
But anyway, I don't. That's a whole other topic.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the system has run out of gas.
Yeah.
I once saw George Soros at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he was describing America as having shot its well, and he stopped himself before he finished his thought. And everybody at the Council on Foreign Relations starts laughing. But America does feel like it has shot its well.
Yeah. I want to give listeners, some sense of how your book moves. So, the first chapter is about novelty and the sense of newness. And you already kind of touched on this. I mean, certainly it's about the internet, but it's a lot about a lot of the other stuff too. And you talk about people like futurist George Gilder and Greenspan and Kevin Kelly and Manuel Castells and all these people who kind of become prophets for the new economy. So, I mean,
you're more familiar with this text than I am now.
Yeah, no, it's okay. I have revisited it a number of times, but I just wonder, my question for you is if we look back on the 90s, how do we account for that sense of aliveness that you've brought up a couple times? Like, what do you think created that? Do you think it was just it was a moment of expansion after lots of decades of contraction, or what was up?
Well, the technology was new. The internet was becoming a mass phenomenon, having been a pretty connoisseur phenomenon earlier. And computers are getting more powerful and cheaper, and you could do things that you couldn't do before. So there was a real being determines consciousness kind of moment that was going on then. When I wrote the book, the first version of it, the hardcover version, I was very skeptical about all the claims about a productivity acceleration.
Yeah, you are in the book. Yep.
And then when the paperback came out, I wrote a long intro in which I sort of changed my mind. And reading Robert Gordon's work on productivity acceleration, I did change my mind to some degree. But it turned out my skepticism was warranted. That productivity acceleration lasted, I don't know, maybe 5 years and then disappeared. And now we're just doing really badly in that department. So it's really strange to have that. That boom came along with a real large rise in capital spending, heavy investment in technological equipment mostly.
Yeah.
Real increase in ICT capital spending. And we haven't seen anything like that in this cycle. There just hasn't been that kind of investment. And the innovation is much less impressive. Now it's just like iterations on things that are pretty familiar. We have a faster iPhone, but the iPhone is what, 10, 12 years old. There's nothing like that. I love my new M1 Macintosh. It's really, really fast, but it's not all that profoundly different from the Macintosh I had 10 years ago.
Yeah.
The break was, greater then. I think the real technical advances were greater then. And I don't know, maybe something in the age makeup of the population. My cohort was, just reaching maturity.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
And we carried our, 60s optimism into a different kind of world. And I don't know, young people today are often rather gloomy about the future, which kind of saddens me. I think, young people are supposed to be, optimistic about the future. They're supposed to be an antidote to the sourness of the aging, but they're not living up to their role at this point. Mm-hmm. But I think, I don't know whether it was that. It seemed like the end of the Cold War put capitalism in a very good mood. It lost any sense of rivalry. There's another way to do things. Capitalism enjoyed a prestige in those moments that, I was talking earlier about the sign over Silicon that said, "Welcome to Silicon Alley." Right up the street, Forbes magazine had a big billboard that celebrating itself as a capitalist tool.
Yeah,
and they're turning around all those old critical terms into reclaiming them. So there was that moment that of intense capitalist triumph. There's no other way to do things. We won, you lost. Get in line and celebrate. And I remember this is many years earlier, but that movie, now I'm forgetting it, in which the running dog shoes, about the boomers who'd given up on their dreams and went into business.
Okay. Oh, it's not Wall Street.
No, it's... Yeah, there's this one scene where like this woman who'd been a public defender went to work as a real estate lawyer, and somebody was giving her a hard time for it. And she said, well, at least they're not rapists. You know, that, oh, that's how they that's how we were processing things. So that was, you know, there's a transformation of the baby boomer consciousness.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Robert Tucker has that great book about the transformation of the whole Earth catalog and that whole sensibility, the hippie sensibility, into the Silicon Valley philosophy. You know, the individualistic libertarianism, which makes one look differently now at hippie culture in retrospect. There was a lot, you know, libertarian individualism to it. There was a lot of other things too, but, you know, the ease with which that transition happened makes you wonder what hippiedom is all about.
Yeah,
but in any case, you know, that there was that celebration of capitalism. Ken Kersen, who had been kind of a radical journalist when he was an undergraduate at the University of Chicago, then was doing this magazine Green, where mutual funds became cool. And yeah, it was just... This was Gen X moving in and thinking that there's something really cool about mutual funds and self-reliance. And, this was part of the sensibility that with the younger people at Wired were part of this cohort.
Yeah.
So you had, you know, the older ones who were making the transition from hippiedom to techdom, but then you had the younger people who'd not known anything but capitalist triumphalism, and they're going to make the best of it.
Yeah.
And now, you know, all these years later, capitalism doesn't look so triumphant. There's an awful lot of alienation from the system. People are not making any money. It's not a very prosperous time.
And that's
one thing. Another thing about the late 90s, there was actually money getting around. You know, I was talking earlier about, you know, I'd walk around the Lower East Side and see all these kids spending lots of money, but they had it.
Yeah.
And you just don't see that now. There's just not that boom was somewhat more democratic, and I use that word advisedly, but it was somewhat more democratic than the recent one was, where money has been kept more, much more closely held. A lot of my comrades in New York City DSA are tech workers, you know, and they are the modern working class in a lot of ways, but they're also people who in an earlier time would have enjoyed professional jobs with high salaries and be rising up the corporate ladder and all those sorts of things. And now that's just not happening. That kind of upward mobility, with some exceptions, but it's not what it used to be. And so they just, you know, this theory by Peter Turchin, who has a book which came out a little while ago. One of his arguments is that we are suffering from overproduction of elites, that all these people who went to school and got fancy degrees and thought they were going to have a nice life in the professional managerial class are finding not having it. And that in combination with downward mobility in the rest of the population leads to a great deal of potential for a social explosion. You know, it's just such a different labor market and such a different material environment from what it was in the late 90s.
Yeah. One of the ways I've started thinking about the new economy, and in part I was like following up on some thoughts in your book, you had this great section in the book that I found refound a couple of years ago and then became really important to me, where you were looking at Robert Reich. So this is a Secretary of Labor under Clinton and was also kind of writing a lot of pop books on, you know, like the knowledge economy or something like that at the time. And you were looking at like how he was very focused on new economy jobs. I found these especially focusing on technicians as a kind of class of workers. But he's talking about all kinds of techie jobs, right?
Oh, yeah. Like, wasn't it a vending machine repairman? Wasn't that one of his examples?
Yeah. He loved that one. Yeah.
Yeah. He's using a printed circuit board and, you know, like not the old mechanical vending machine thing.
Yeah.
Well, Jesus, you know, all the guy does is pull out the old board and put in the new one. It's not like he's wiring it himself. You know?
But part of what you show is that he didn't even though he was Secretary of Labor, he's not reading the publications of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, because what the BLS was showing at that time when he's the labor secretary, they were already projecting the, you know, the fastest jobs growing in America were going to be very low wage service jobs like home health care aides, for instance. And part of what I've started to feel is that, like, what a lot of these guys, the new economy thinkers, and new economy thinkers are like a bunch of economists too, not just Reich and not just Greenspan, but a bunch of folks, is in the Clinton White House, it was like they're kind of projecting forward from this spurt of expansion, right? As if this was like the new economy is going to be like this long period of expansion and abundance. And they project it way forward when it turned out to be a couple years. Does that sound right? Is just like making false inferences or something?
Yeah, well, there's certainly a lot of that. And, you know, the BLS is making similar projections today.
Yeah,
if you look at their projections for what's going to be required over the next decade, it's a lot of, I can't remember the exact numbers, but maybe 2/3 of the jobs don't even require a college degree, maybe an associate's degree, but nothing higher, and some short on-the-job training. And, you know, there will be a minority of nice, fancy jobs. And that was the same thing that was being projected in the late 90s, which is the way things worked out. You know, about, say, roughly, you know, the middle has been emptying out. There's just not a whole lot of good jobs in the middle anymore, the way there used to be. And maybe, you know, 1/3 of that has gone upwards, but 2/3 have gone downwards. Mm-hmm. And something similar still is happening. Last few years, we've seen some improvement in the fortunes for the low-wage labor market. With low unemployment rates, tight labor markets. But unfortunately, some of those gains have been eaten up by inflation, so they're not even really durable gains. But that aside, I think also a lot of people, academics, professionals, journalists, saw what was happening in their own jobs and that of their friends. And the late 90s is a great time to be a journalist. There's a lot of money in the field. A lot of startup publications. It was the days when Condé Nast, I knew some people who worked for Vanity Fair, and had a neighbor on the Upper West Side who was their art critic for a while. And they would fly him and his wife to a gallery opening in Paris. Nothing spectacular. It's not like, you know, a major museum retrospective exhibit. No, just a gallery opening in Paris. And the two of them would go first class. And this was life at Condé Nast, writing for Vanity Fair in those days. Yeah. So, you know, they thought, wow, everybody's living large now. And then, you know, it's changing the way academics did research, having so much information online, you know. I still feel this as a journalist. It's so much easier to do research now than it was 30 years ago. You know, and I could find things in 3 minutes that it would take a long trip to the library to find. There's a downside to that, but, you know, it's mostly an upside. But I think the people, some of the people who write and think about these things came to just generalize their experience that the whole world was going through this revolution and everybody was feeling really creative. But even at the time, I remember thinking, well, there are far more truck drivers than there are computer programmers.
Yeah, totally.
And, you know, and all these celebrations, you never hear that. And then if you talk about the world scale, you know, there's still then, probably a bit smaller proportion now, but then about half the world were living in poor countries as farmers, peasants.
Yeah.
You know, that was the modal human experience was not that of an urban knowledge worker. And, you know, certainly there's been some urbanization over the last 20, 30 years. You know, the formal labor force has expanded compared to what it was then. But still, you know, this is just not representative of the way people live their lives. It just became easy to think so as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is kind of, you know, this is in some ways an impossible question, but I wondered, like, overall, like, what role the stock market plays in the new economy story? Because it's like, if you look at, like, the use of the term, according to Google Ngram, at least, like, which tracks, you know, phrase and word use over time, in 2002... use of the phrase the new economy basically falls off a cliff face, right? I mean, it's like between 2000 and 2002, air is going out of the dot-com bust is happening, air is going out of that bubble.
And it seems like the term is very tied up with that, because like productivity doesn't start falling for another couple years, right? It's like 2004 or something like that. It starts going down.
Yeah.
So it just seems like, was the new economy really like a stock market story, or like it was really about markets more than anything?
Oh, a lot of it was. Yeah. I mean, it was a byproduct, but also fed it. You know, it became this, I don't want to call it a virtuous circle, but it's something that fed in itself. And we saw that again, you know, in the recent episode that the Fed pumping $3 or $4 trillion in the economy, keeping interest rates at zero for a decade.
Yeah.
That just led to an immense amount of exuberance, irrational exuberance, as Greenspan famously put it. but also, there's just so much money to play with. The Fed was just printing all this money, and the real economy was not doing so great. And a lot of it just went into the financial markets. And people in the markets who have an outsized influence on public discourse, and people who own stocks also have an outsized influence in public discourse, they're having a great time. Everything is doing great for them. And the Trump economy wasn't that bad. The unemployment rate was pretty low. Wages were rising, more than they are under Biden, I have to admit, even more than under Obama as well. But it was not a great time. It was not the working class was not rolling in money. But the financial markets are doing great, and so it's easy to say everything is going great. And then we had that moment of was it February, March 2021, the meme stock moment. And,
Everyone's at home playing with apps with Robinhood or
whatever. It's just a crazy moment. I actually got into the Daily Show to talk about it.
Oh, really? I missed that. Oh, bummer.
it was a lot of fun. But, I always figure when I get attention from mainstream outlets that whatever phenomenon – whatever phenomenon is being talked about is just about over.
Man.
So that's what I felt. Being on the Daily Show, this meme stock thing is just about over. And, that was the peak in a lot. Also, what's her name? Kathy Wood, one of the hero portfolio managers of that period, her ARK fund. Peaked around then, too. I haven't looked at it lately, but it's probably recovered some, but it really, really took a dive. But she and her stocks were symbols of that period, and it was just utterly insane the stuff that was going on around meme stocks.
And totally.
I just looked at it like, what? It's the same feeling I had at the Pseudo Studios. Like, what is going on here? This cannot last.
I know, man. Something you might mention it in your book, but I was most recently reminded of it by Nelson, the labor historian Nelson Lichtenstein has a book coming out on the Clinton administration this fall. And I've read it a couple times. And I didn't realize that, or I hadn't remembered at least, that Fed rates played a role in the dot-com buildup too, just as we've seen in the 2010s. Maybe a smaller one, because we basically had ZERP for a long time in the 2010s, but I just hadn't put the two and two. I mean, it seems like Fed policy is actually playing a role in these recurrent asset bubbles at this point.
Oh, definitely. And Greenspan was a real cheerleader for the new economy. I used to make fun of him in my newsletter because he would say the most preposterous things. He's like, everything is getting so small and light. He's trying to, the weight of the economy, just the physical weight of the economy was so much lighter than it used to be. He'd like get all gee-whizzy about this sort of stuff. And,
because we're making chips and stuff? Is that the idea?
Okay. There was this outbreak of belief that we were post-material somehow.
Kevin Kelly says this explicitly in that book you mentioned.
And then Charles Leadbeater, who had been the industry economist for industry correspondent for the Financial Times, then discovered the new economy and wrote this book called Lighter Than Air, I think it was called.
Okay.
He later became the editor for Bridget Jones' Diary. So we also.
I mean, and you also have Jeremy Rifkin during that period, like the World Without Work and all that.
Stanley Aronowitz, The End of Work. all this. Like,
we've heard that again this time again in like more than once, right?
Yeah, now yeah. It's AI. Like, you know.
But it's been AI twice because there was a second machine age moment in like 2014 to 2015. Now we're hearing it with generative AI. It's just like the script just plays out again and again.
Yeah, it really feels like another, like AI feels like another bubble. There was a headline in the Financial Times that effect the other day. And I was like, yeah, I think we may be there. But going back to Greenspan, he was such a cheerleader for this stuff.
Yeah.
And he, at some point, really believed in the productivity revolution. And so he said, because this revolution in productivity, we can maintain lower rates of interest, higher levels of economic growth without worrying about inflation.
Okay.
Tighter labor markets. That's where he would famously talked about the conundrum. People would make fun of him a little bit for this conundrum of tight labor markets, but with no wage increases. And he explicitly said also that working class was scared. They were still afraid of layoffs.
Uh-huh.
And restructurings, which had been so prominent in the 80s and early 90s that it had really scarred the sensibilities of the working class. They were just terrified that they were going to lose their jobs or skills would become obsolete or their firms were going to move away or, you know, just some bad things befall them.
Yeah.
So they'd never ask for a raise. They'd do whatever the boss said. And Greenspan is very explicit about celebrating that.
Wow.
But, you know, his belief in this productivity revolution was what enabled him to keep interest rates very, very low for a long period of time that allowed the dot-com bubbles to blow up, not in the sense of exploding, but expanding,
and
blew up in the sense of exploding once they started raising rates. But, yeah, it was a similar thing. So we've, you know, a lot of people's understanding of the Federal Reserve and its policies and its functions were shaped by the Volcker years and William Grider's famous book on the Volcker years, Secrets of the Temple. But, you know, Volcker left in 87. And that period of really tight money, 1979 to 82, but, you know, it stayed pretty tight from 82 until Volcker left. And then, you know, when Greenspan came, happy days are here again. And, you know, he never really deliberately created a recession. He started raising interest rates soon after taking over, but then we had the 1987 stock market crash. And Greenspan said, oh, no, we can't have that. And so they issued a press release right after the financial, the 87 crash and said, the Federal Reserve, in accordance with its duties, will make sure that things don't go all to hell. In politer terms. That was really the beginning of the modern bailout culture. So finance came to think that it could just do anything and get away with it. There's a story of Sonny Barger, who was the number two guy in the Hell's Angels for many years. And he had just getting accidents after accident. And then finally he had a really bad one. Spent some time in a coma. Then he woke up and the nurse said, I hope you learned your lesson, Mr. Barger. And he said, yes, I did. And she said, what's that? He said, I can do anything and survive.
Oh, man.
But that's the lesson that finance learned from the Greenspan years. And you saw just one after another of these bailouts. The late 90s, we had the Asian financial crisis, Russia financial crisis. Early 2000s, you know, we had the dot-com bust. And then we had, you know, after the 2008 crisis, we had just, you know, the Fed pumping and keeping rates at zero. And, you know, that doesn't mean that austerity is great, but, you know, the financier class has not taken a hit of any magnitude. I don't know, since 1929, 32, you know, like they've just been bailed out serially. So their share of the wealth and income just keeps rising. And, you know, it's flat over periods of time, but it hasn't gone down ever, you know, since the early 1970s.
Yeah. So part of what I wanted to do and, you know, kind of making some final moves in our discussion is kind of connecting it to the last decade, your book. And we've already been doing that some, but I want to do it deeper. And I feel like you've kind of just set it up. The way I tell the story, or the way I've been thinking about the story, is when the Fed comes in after 2008, they put interest rates to zero, they're pumping in lots of cash. One of the things that comes out of that is by 2012, 2013, we're starting to see bubbly activity around a lot of different technologies, right? There's like social media, there's Uber and Lyft and all those gig economy, sharing economy firms. There's self-driving cars and drones. You know, we've had two waves of AI hype in the last decade, including those ones in 2014, 2015 and all that. Blockchain, Web3 and the metaverse. So it just keeps going
Web
on,
three.
Right?
Web3 is one of the most comical ones in this whole series.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I loved it. My feeling about Web3 was it was really like a last breath, a gasp of like that moment. But then the generative AI thing happened. So new air got kicked in there. But do you remember when it started feeling like kind of like another asset bubble like 2000, like the 90s to you?
Well, I wrote a couple of pieces for The Nation on this. I remember I wrote one about the unicorn moment. I can't remember when that was.
Yeah.
And then I wrote a piece about Bitcoin. I think that was 2014.
Uh-huh.
And at that point, I thought, Bitcoin, this stuff is insane.
Yeah.
Like, how's this going to last? You know, here we are 10 years later, and it's, you know, it's a little staggering, but it's still going.
Mm-hmm.
Weird sell-off in Bitcoin last week, but I don't know what that was all about. But in any case, it's something which makes no sense at all. I don't really understand why it exists or what problem it's meant to solve.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are an awful lot of passionate believers still who are... It's always hard to separate the passionate believers from the con men, too. I mean,
totally.
The history of capitalism is... Marx has a phrase, something about how the apostles of credit always have this nicely mixed character of swindler and prophet.
Huh.
And, you know, that's just been a constant. Yeah. Swindler and prophet, sometimes they're different people, sometimes they're the same person.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's been about almost 10 years that I've had this sensation of deja vu all over again. You know, it's... But it got crazier. You know, Bitcoin, when I wrote that, was, well, I don't know, who knows what was in 2014, $1,000? I don't know.
Yeah.
Now it's 20-something. Like, it's hard to keep up with whatever Bitcoin is. But, you know, $20,000 or $30,000. And, you know, then there's thousands of other cryptocurrencies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the whole scene has managed to survive these collapses and the revelations of fraud and, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried going to the Brooklyn House of Detention. It's surprising it's managed to survive that, but it has. You know, the stock market is somewhat off its highs, but it's still pretty richly valued.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, too. I mean, like, a lot of the air went out of the bubble last year. I mean, like, you know, stupid things like metaverse real estate really took a hit in 2022, right? And Web3.
I remember reading that stuff, like, you know, people actually talking about real estate development in the metaverse. Good Lord.
Yeah. But, you know, the stock market's come back a lot in 2023. So, I mean, how have you been thinking about that as someone who follows this pretty closely?
Well, you know, some of my left-wing friends are going to criticize me for this, but, you know, it makes me think the Fed isn't being tight enough when I see stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, this is a real serious problem that we have very crude tools for managing the economy. And one of them is monetary policy, interest rates, and the quantity of money. Over the last, I don't know, a couple of decades, it's become... It's as if the prosperity of the real economy is a byproduct of the financial markets. So we allow these insane bubbles to develop, immense waste of capital and human intelligence, and human resources.
Yep.
This recent last 2-3 years, we had a very substantial housing boom, or in prices. but there was very little new construction. And so unlike the housing bubble of the early and mid 2000s, when there was still a lot of construction, which is one of the things that brought that one to an end, as prices rose, supply increased, and therefore prices came down. But we haven't seen that this time very much. This current housing bubble has been mostly people in the upper brackets, people with very high credit scores, unlike the one of the earlier, of 15, 20 years ago, which was driven by people with low credit scores. And God knows people with low credit score needs housing, but they don't need easy loans that they can't afford. But this decades now of super easy money and indulgence from the Federal Reserve and other central banks around the world too, has just produced this incredibly distorted system where financial markets get crazy, and you don't want to see the unemployment rate go up, and what bargaining power workers have gained because of low unemployment rates, you don't want to see that evaporate. But on the other hand, we got to do something about these insane financial markets and this system of feeling entitled to a bailout every time something goes wrong. So we saw the Silicon Valley Bank failure of, God, when was that? Early this year. It sort of seems like ancient history. And then a couple of crypto banks failed at the same time. And it was in important part because the Fed had tightened, and all the bonds that these guys had loaded up on lost value, and that meant that the banks were insolvent. And the Fed paused its tightening some. But this underlying problem didn't go away. There's still a lot of risky stuff in bank balance sheets. We could see another round of this. I think the only way to really deal with this is by regulating finance. But also just relying on super tight labor markets in order to provide wage increases and some degree of job security, it's got a problem. We should have different regulation of the labor market, better minimum wages, stronger unions, a civilized welfare state, things that have some at least potential durability, whereas just relying on a low unemployment rate to do all the work is a kind of neoliberal approach to things. It was what Bill Clinton believed, It's we've got this economic model now though where it's just all dependent on indulgence from the monetary authority and little else. We had that great moment or a couple of great moments during the pandemic, which is, don't get me wrong, a horrible thing, but we did have for a moment a semi generous welfare state, and it made an enormous difference for an awful lot of
people. Huge.
And if only we could have made that permanent, if we could have that permanent child allowance, if we could have, a much more generous unemployment system, people accumulated a high amount of savings, and have been able to, they've been living on that to some degree for the last year or two. That now seems to be all gone or very close.
Auto loan repayment starting to fall. I mean, there's starting to be problems showing up, it looks like.
And there was also the long student loan moratorium, which is coming to an end. That was a great thing. We could have done a lot more of that. But it shows what a good policy can do. And it can do more than just relying solely on a 3.5% unemployment rate to do all the work of putting a floor under the living standards of the working class. Yeah. And, then there's the whole critique that work sucks anyway. So what do you want to do about that?
Well, man, Doug, thank you so much for taking the time and talking to me today. Where can people find you? I mean, you got your radio show and podcast, Behind the News, and what else? Where can people look for you?
I write for Jacobin now and then. I'm doing for something for them right now on Bidenomics, whatever that is.
Okay. Oh my God, we could do a whole hour on that. I can't wait to hear your take on Bidenomics.
And then. No, I do write things for my blog now and then, which is lbo-news.com. Pretty much everything I do is reported on there, and all my radio shows are listed on there. I should write more frequently than I do, but writing is hard work.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Doug, thanks so much, man. This has been great.
All right, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of our podcast. You can reach us with questions, comments, and suggestions at leevinsel@gmail.com or by following me on Twitter at STS_news or on YouTube at People's Things. Our podcast is distributed by the New Books Network, the leading platform for academic podcasts, so that you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Peoples and Things, like most things in this world, depends on the work of many people. I want to thank my brother Jake Vinsel for writing the music for the show. I want to thank my buddy Juliana Castro for designing the logos for the podcast. You can check out her work at julianacastro.co. Joe Fort is the producer for the podcast, and Mandy Lamb is the production assistant. This podcast and other Peoples and Things programming are produced in affiliation with Virginia Tech Publishing and supported by the Center for Humanities and the University Libraries at Virginia Tech. For information about other podcasts from Virginia Tech Publishing, visit publishing.vt.edu. For the entire Peoples and Things team, I am Lee Vinsel. And most importantly, I want to thank you for listening. Thanks.